Welcome one and all to Productivity Book Group. I'm your host and facilitator, Ray Sidney Smith. Thanks for joining us here for this Productivity Book Group Summary Review episode. Today on this call, we will be discussing the four tendencies, the indispensable personality profiles that reveal how to make your life better and other people's lives better too, by Gretchen Rubin. I am joined on this episode by Dr. Frank Buck. Welcome, Frank.
Thanks, Ray. It's good to be with you.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So Frank and I are going to be discussing the four tendencies. And as I like to always start out these discussions with a little bit about the author and a little bit about the book, let's start off with Gretchen Rubin. Many of you will have known her from prior book discussions, but Gretchen Rubin, from her back cover inside of The Four Tendencies, reads, is one of the most influential writers on human nature. Her books, such as the blockbuster bestsellers The Happiness Project and my favorite, Better Than Before, have sold almost 3 million copies in more than 30 languages. She also hosts a popular award-winning podcast, Happier with Gretchen Rubin, which her co-host is her sister, and she's been interviewed by Oprah, she's eaten dinner with Dr. Daniel Kahneman, and walked arm-in-arm with the Dalai Lama. Rubin started her career in law and was clerking for the Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor when she realized she wanted to be a writer, and she lives in New York City with her family. So that's Gretchen Rubin, and she has written this book, which in the inside cover of the book, it calls it a groundbreaking analysis of personality type. And I find this really interesting, and this is where I'd really like to start off the discussion with you, Frank, is that Gretchen has started this kind of multi-book investigation into human nature, as she says here, and she realized this one particular question that she wanted to answer, which is, how do I respond to expectations? And from that started this investigation, which actually began in Better Than Before. She starts off this discussion of these four tendencies, and she makes her way through this discovery of four different types of personality types she has defined as the upholder, questioner, obliger, and rebel. So starting off the discussion, Frank, did Gretchen Rubin find the four personality types as you see them? What was your initial sort of reaction or response to the concept of the personality types? And we'll go from there.
Well, I think what she has done is put together a very simple model, kind of a, she shows it as four interlocking rings. It could have been described as four quadrants, but to break things down is, how we respond to expectations from within ourselves, internal expectations and external expectations. So it's definitely a very simple model. I think it's one that's worth a lot of thought. I don't know if we have if we've left some things out with a model that's simple, but it certainly is interesting.
I think that the idea of the simplicity of it is quite remarkable, right? I think that there's something very remarkable about it. There is, of course, a huge caveat here, which is that this is not a scientific treatise. This is a casual observer's view of quite a bit of research and self-exploration and exploration of her audience, her community, which, in some way, shape, or form is biased because it self-selects. So these are people who were willing to be interviewed or willing to be surveyed, who were already aware of Gretchen Rubin and her work, and so therefore, in some way, shape, or form, is a select group of people. That being the case, there was an interesting representative sample within each of the groups that tended toward these four tendencies. Now, I come from a background of being very interested in personality type indicators like the Myers-Briggs, Kiersey Temperament Sorter, Enneagram, DISC, and so on and so forth. And so I come at this with the four tendencies being very useful in the very, very narrow definition which she provides, which is, how do I respond to expectations? If you try to look at it beyond that scope, then I think that it starts to break down, and rightly so, because that's not what Rubin was attempting to do. So I think you have to put it, if you frame it appropriately in that space, I think it's a highly useful tool for being able to deal with several things that we'll have a discussion about in this episode. So first and foremost, I kind of wanted to go over the four tendencies and what she does in the table of contents. You'll see in the book, she actually goes ahead and breaks this up into the four tendencies. So first she starts out with kind of, you know, how the four tendencies originated in her exploration of that, and then she goes into a quiz where she then asks you, you know, to take this quiz to figure out which of the four tendencies you might be, and then she talks about each of the four tendencies and then applying the four tendencies in your life. So I want to kind of jump into just a brief explanation of the four tendencies so that we're all on the same page, and then we'll talk about how she discusses all of the tendencies, strengths, weaknesses, and really how to deal with each of the tendencies as a construct when you're dealing with people. So let's start off with the upholder. So Frank, I know a little bit about you because of this, which is to say that you're an upholder. So describe to us what an upholder is.
The upholder is someone who meets inner expectations and meets outer expectations. So, and yes, I'm an upholder. As I started reading the book and started reading the part about the upholder, I'm thinking, that's me. And then as I took the quiz, and one thing I like about this book, anybody who reads the book can take the quiz and get the answer back. It's a fairly short quiz. The answer comes back to you quickly with a description of what that means to you. Whereas some other books, you know, you have to pay a little money to take the quiz, or only the first person who reads the book and puts in a special code can take it, that sort of thing. But anybody can take this quiz. It did tell me I was an upholder. And I got to confess one thing. As we were scheduling this particular interview, one thing that I was keeping in the back of my head was, when's the book due back to the library? Now, of course, the fine, you know, would be like 25 cents total or something like that. But to me, that's not the point. This was the due date to the library. The library is expecting me to return the book by a certain date. So it's got to happen. So yeah, I'm definitely an upholder. And I think one of the things about we who are upholders is we think the whole world would be better off if we were all upholders.
And as we learn throughout the book, that is certainly not true.
Yes.
But I appreciate the concept of upholders, and to some extent, I think this is one of the appropriate places to kind of accent this point, which is that people exhibit these tendencies. These are tendencies, and so therefore, we will tend to do some of these things some of the time. And so I can very much see myself tending to be an upholder in certain modes, in certain roles, in certain areas of my life, whereas in other areas of my life, I tend to fall into the obliger category. And so I think that's probably the next area that we should describe. So
yeah, see, Ray, I would have thought you were an upholder. Now, for our audience, Ray and I have never met in person. Our interaction has been on things like this, these type of book discussions, and then a weekly prod chat, Twitter chat. So, and then, of course, a number of emails back and forth. But Ray, I would have thought you were an upholder.
Yeah, and the little quiz gave me the obliger category. And again, this is where it becomes kind of fluid, right? Because I think that in certain roles in my life, I'm very much an upholder. I meet my inner and outer expectations and go on with my life. But in other areas of my life, I really do need external accountability and outer expectations to be able to manage, because otherwise I don't see their importance. The DMV registration for my vehicle, I just got it for the new year, except that I registered for 2 years. So the renewal that showed up is clearly, in my eyes, not important. If it were not for the notice that's telling me that I need to pay for the next 2 years for a year from now, I would not at all seek out doing that thing. Right, that wouldn't be something that I would get on my. So, but because the letter came and with the invoice, I'm going to pay it because it's my obligation, I'm definitely an obliger in the sense that the obligation is now there and I don't want to leave it for some later date. So I just rather deal with it now. And so I'm not quite sure where that falls into upholder or obliger, but I certainly see them being a little bit of both. I don't know.
You know, and I guess one thing, since both the upholder and obliger meet outer expectations, and I see you on a regular basis meeting those outer expectations, such as today's call, you know, we're both on time, we're both prepared, et cetera, et cetera. But since I'm not seeing you on a day-to-day basis and not seeing how you are, say, some of your own New Year's resolutions, for example, I don't know how you're coming with those. I don't necessarily know all of the, maybe the struggles that are going on privately. I just see that outward persona and the outward expectations that you're meeting.
And I think that's a really important point, which is that you see a glimpse of people if you don't, say, live with that person. And even if you do live with a person, you probably don't, if you don't live and work with that person, then you probably only get to see a part of every individual that you ever know, right? And so in those environments, you have to understand whether they might be one of these categories in that role, but not in their entire life. And I think that of myself. I've really been giving some thought to this since we last spoke, and I really have the sense that I might just be. It's not like multiple personality disorder or anything like that, but I certainly have different expectation tendencies when I'm in different roles, you know? So in my work life, I'm very much an upholder, but in my personal life, I'm definitely an obliger. So I just find myself to be more of that when I look at it from those different roles. And so I think there's a little bit of wiggle room here. But the obliger, just to be clear, is someone who meets outer expectations and resists inner expectations. And so that's the obliger role. If we continue around it, and I'm looking at the chart that's actually in the book, and I will place an image of that in the show notes, so you'll be able to see that there at productivitybookgroup.org. And so if we continue clockwise around the four circles, the Venn diagram that Ruben has put together, we come to the rebel. Now the rebel. And Frank, you can correct me if I'm wrong. The rebel is the person who is, I think, probably creates the most conflict when it comes to the other tendencies, the other personality types, in the sense that the rebel resists outer and inner expectations. My perspective on this is that the rebel is probably the person who you provide information and the hope for a decision, and you don't necessarily know what you're going to get. There is a lot of variability in, and there are very many, many unknowns about their decision-making process. Frank, do you have any rebels in your life? Do you experience this?
Thinking back to my days as a principal, definitely. And I think you need to have a rebel, maybe sort of a rebel you can control a little bit, but that person who thinks outside the box, that person who does their own thinking, they're definitely not a yes person, that they can play the role of the devil's advocate. And that, you know, if that rebel says, "Yeah, I think that's a good idea," then you know they really think that's a good idea, not just telling you what you think they want you to hear. So, you know, I think every organization needs one, but again, one that you can control to a certain extent. But you know, a lot of good ideas can come from that person, and it's just I think good to have those kind of people in your life.
I'd agree. I have a rebel in my world, and they kind of straddle the rebel questioner line there. And I think it's really important for us all to recognize how rebels work, and so we can have a more thoughtful discussion. I'm going to describe what the questioner is, and so the questioner is the personality type that resists outer expectations but meets inner expectations. And so if someone requests something from them, that is not as high of an importance to them as when they want to do something that they expect themselves to do. And this is really fundamentally where I think the questioner and the rebel differ. So the questioner is actually quite comfortable with their inner decisions, but are not comfortable with their outer expectations and the decisions they make to people outside of themselves. Whereas the rebel is very comfortable with the decision once it's made, as you said, but I think what's not implied in the material, but what I have kind of couch psychologist diagnosed, is that rebels are actually really fearful of the idea of making a mistake, of potentially committing to something that they wouldn't be able to commit to, and so therefore, until they feel comfortable with that fear or that discomfort, they will not make the decision. And I might very well be wrong here, but I have this strong sense that rebels really have that discomfort with the idea that they won't make good on something, so they're not going to commit to anything until such time as they fully believe that they can make good on it. And then it's all right.
I think that's a good description. I would agree.
Yeah, and so then we get through along in the book, and we have to kind of discuss how Gretchen kind of and Gretchen Rubin herself is an upholder, right? So she self-defines as an upholder, and she talks about this idea that one needs to really deal with being an upholder differently than all the other groups, because you are in the super minority, right? The upholders are the smallest group of people, and the largest group are obligers. So most people tend to fall into the obligers. And again, this is the self-selected group of people who have taken the survey, which is the basis of the quote unquote study that Gretchen has done in order to show these numbers. But I think it's pretty easy to understand that that's probably the case. So we see the upholder as the first category that Gretchen talks about, and just as a side note, she uses the quotation "discipline is my freedom" as kind of the quote the quote for that. And to be quite honest, I would like you, Frank, I would probably self-define and say that that's something that's very near and dear to my heart as a value statement, and so it is something that I'm always curious about, but. So since you're the upholder, what are some of the things that as an upholder I think is really important in terms of people dealing with you and you dealing with the world to be productive?
Well, I think what other people would need to understand about an upholder is, we're going to do what we say we're going to do. We don't need reminders. In fact, I'm a little bit annoyed with the reminder. Yep, if I've got a dental appointment, you tell me when it is, 6 months ahead of time, it's going on my calendar, I'm going to show up. Now, if you send me a text to confirm it, I'm going to stop what I'm doing. I'm going to, as I'm working with other texts, I'm going to look at my calendar to determine that if the reminder that you have sent me matches up with what's actually on my calendar, to make sure the dentist hasn't made a mistake. I'm going to confirm that, yes, that we are both in agreement, and going to go, I could have saved some time. I wish they wouldn't do that. And when they follow up the text with another text the next day, just to make sure that I got the first text and an email and a phone call, and I'm going, look, I own a calendar. And when I sit in, say I'm waiting to get my hair cut, and there's the receptionist who's calling all the people who are supposed to come in tomorrow to remind them, I'm going, look, couldn't we all save each other a lot of time by everybody owning a calendar and actually keeping it up to date? But I know everybody's not like me. So that's sort of us as upholders. That's how to work with us. We'll do what we say we're going to do. We need the clear direction. You know, I'm going to ask questions on the front end to make sure that what it is I am supposed to do is exactly what it is I'm supposed to do. So I may need some clarification on the front end, but then, let me go and, and I'm going to be fine and realize I may get a little, even though I don't say it, I may get a little impatient internally with people that don't operate that way.
And I think it's really important to recognize that this is not like you're wrong or bad or right or righteous for being an upholder or one of the other social styles or personality types here for expectations. I think it's really important to remember that you're the upholder, not you specifically, Frank, but the upholder personality type generally feels defensive and can even be frustrated with the idea of making mistakes, right? So there's a bit of perfectionism there. And when you're dealing with upholders, you need to be very conscious about allowing them to save face if they have made a mistake. And I fall into this category most definitely. So now all of a sudden I'm feeling much more an upholder today than I feel an obliger.
That's right. I don't like to make mistakes. And, if I'm caught in a mistake, it's not that I'm upset with the other person for pointing it out. I'm more upset with myself for making it. This is something I should have known better. I should have known to double check this and so forth and so on. And I'm pretty likely to put the blame on myself rather than try to make excuses. Because when I do make the excuses, then I give up the freedom. That if I take responsibility for the mistake, then I'm also still in control of my life. Whereas if I'm putting the blame somewhere else, I'm also putting the control of my life in someone else's hands. And that I don't like.
For me, part of the issue is, I think the same, is that because I take responsibility for a mistake, I don't feel like I need double the pressure to fix it or deal with it. So when someone else brings up the mistake, or what have you, maybe it's even a perception of me dropping the ball or otherwise, I'm now upset with the fact that my system failed me. I'm upset with the fact that, I'm upset with myself. And now this other thing outside of me is causing me more distress. And so it's not that I'm frustrated with that person necessarily. It's the fact that I already have the internal functions for lashing myself, right? I already have the self-flagellation and all of that, stuff built into me to get me going again. I don't need the outside, forces to make that happen for me, in at least for me, what I believe are my work roles. So I think that's probably where that frustration comes from, sort of an upholder perspective, is like, yeah, I don't need you to tell me that I'm wrong or that I've done something wrong. I already am very much aware of it. So just bringing it up and letting the point be, and then stepping away from it and allowing an upholder to save face, I think causes a great deal of, a great deal less conflict than pushing and pointing out all of the various mistakes. And I think I now know why the rebel in my life and I have so much conflict. So let's make our way along to the obliger, and I'm just following along again with the Venn diagram in clockwise format, although Gretchen goes from upholder to questioner to obliger and then rebel. I'm going out of the order of the book just purely for the fact that I started our discussion off following the clockwise around the Venn diagram. So we come to the obliger, and the obliger is, again, like we said, meets outer expectations, but struggles to meet inner expectations. And I will speak very, very briefly about this in the sense that I think that obligers work best from not only Gretchen's discussion of it, but also my own experience with this, with having external accountability to making these things happen. And I'll give a great example of that. These productivity book group summary review discussions. It's something that I have for a long time wanted to do, but I don't like the idea of it me just talking by myself all the time about books. And so I reached out to Frank and I said, hey, Frank, would you like to be on these calls with me? And that little bit of external accountability just, you know, and obviously the format of the show lends, I think, to a better listening experience for you on the other side. But it really is the thing that kicked this into gear. And as an obliger in this particular capacity, I just, bam, I was ready to go. So you can see how just using a little bit of external accountability for an obliger can be very, very powerful, whether it's self-designed or designed outside of the obliger. So creating a little bit of external accountability for them is a creative process.
Now, Ray, did you say this is the largest group?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I missed that particular thing in the book. But as I read through it and looked at the characteristics of the obliger, you know, so much of what I see written in the time management, productivity, organizational literature seems as it's written toward the obliger. That you have to learn to say no, that you can't take on too many things. It all of that seems to match up with things that the obliger would need to hear. So with that being the largest group, I think that makes sense that so much of the literature in time management and productivity is saying that sort of thing.
And I think that actually properly defines the problem with a lot of the time management articles that are on the web. If you happen to be an upholder, questioner, or rebel, you're going to have a real problem with the fact that some of these tactics, techniques, strategies are inappropriate for your expectation styles. So while some of them are actually really great, I think that accountability is something that, for the most part, is good for almost everyone. And there, in my perspective, there are many different types of accountability. But generally, humans are well controlled in a positive way. But you know, they know how to create control for themselves, and it's good to be able to help work with others through accountability. But there are other mechanisms that are just not going to help people. You know, giving directives to rebels without the information and pressing them for more, you know, or pressing them to make a decision sooner is not going to help a rebel, right? That is going to make them do the opposite.
They'll rebel even more.
Absolutely, absolutely. It's in the name, rebel.
You'll get it when you get it, you know, so leave me alone. And, you know, if you ask for it for tomorrow, well, I was going to give it to you day after tomorrow, but since you're bugging me, you'll see it 2 weeks from now.
Exactly. I do want to close out our discussion on obliger just with a couple of points that the book makes that I think are really salient here, which is that, as you kind of noted, Frank, is that obligers tend to take on too many demands. As Francis Wade would call a time demand, they take on too many things that take up their time, and so they have then trouble releasing those things, whether that be just getting rid of it and saying I won't do this, renegotiating, delegating, and dealing with those kinds of things. So if you're an obliger, developing those skills are a real asset to you in being able to combat what is your greatest weakness. So don't look at this as you're somehow flawed. This is a part of who you are, and it is not to be looked at as a flaw, but looked at as an area in which you can create skills to shore up those things from being weaknesses in managing expectations. So I just think it's good for us to keep that in mind.
Yeah. And a final thought that I had on the obliger, you know, it's the person who takes on a lot of things, who says yes, 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 yes. But then if they don't feel appreciated, or if they become overwhelmed, can sort of shut down immediately. So for instance, in a school setting, it might be that PTA president who does so many things and then all of a sudden comes in one day out of the blue and says, I'm resigning as PTA president. Boom, just over. So I think we need to recognize who the obligers are in our organization and realize that even though on the outside things are looking pretty good, that on the inside do, you know, even though on the outside the person is saying yes, 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 and inside they're struggling with how to get it all done and maybe about to shut down, we may need to look at the obliger and go, you know, I think they're probably saying yes to too many things. And just because they said yes to me doesn't mean I need to put more on them. In fact, maybe I need to take the reins and take a little bit off of them. Not because they have said this needs to happen, but because I can see what's going to happen if I don't relieve them of some of that pressure.
Yeah, and I think that if you're a manager in any way, shape, or form, you need to learn how to, you know, command and control the appropriate expectations for obligers, because it's absolutely true. You know, you'll keep giving things to obligers, and of course, they're going to oblige. They're going to say, yes, sure, I'll do it. Yeah, sure, I'll do it. And then eventually, they are going to crack. Or you're not going to get the performance you want out of them, and it's going to be a shock to you, and it shouldn't be. You know, and I'm probably different than most other consultants in that regard, because I think it's your fault, not the obligers. And so I have to constantly say to executives and professionals who are in management, you know, if you have someone who's underperforming, there are very few circumstances, very few categories where it's the direct report's fault. It's usually the manager. And I know it's a tough pill to swallow, but it is up to you to manage. And if they are not doing the things that you are managing, then it falls on you. So anyway, that's a different side topic. But moving on to the rebels, as we were talking about the rebels a little bit in the terms of the fact that they tend to rebel or seemingly rebel. I don't believe that it's rebelliousness. I believe that it's protection. I believe that they're actually protecting their time and their expectations, again, coming from this fear or discomfort of not being able to do what they say they're going to do. But, you know, sometimes they can be seen as, Gretchen Rubin says, that they could be uncooperative or be shown as inconsiderate. And I think that's the same of upholders, right? Because upholders know how to meet their inner expectations very well. And so in that same sense, they tend to look maybe inconsiderate.
That's right, because if I can meet my expectations, by golly, everybody ought to be able to meet their expectations. You know, I can see a lot of that in myself. But I think, you know, in working with a lot of other people and with age, you know, that mellows. I'm not near as much of that mindset now as I was, say, my 21, 22-year-old self.
But even then, I think that we all don't recognize that when an upholder wants to do something and goes and does it, they don't necessarily feel a sense that that's wrong, that's completely appropriate for them to go do that thing. And so they'll say, you know, I don't want to have dinner with you. I want to go to the movies, and I'm going to the movies by myself, right? And and that can almost feel abrupt or off-putting. That's not at all on the radar of the upholder that would be inappropriate, because it's an inner expectation and their inner expectations are important to them, and end of story. And I think that's just something that we all who are dealing with upholders need to be aware of and not take offense to. Right? You could just not take offense to it. And I think a lot of people take offense to things that the rebels do more than upholders, but let's get into that. So the rebel is identified in Gretchen Rubin's summary here of the rebel as having an independent mind, being able to think creatively. They are not swayed by conventions in general. You know, they will shirk convention, and they'll just go ahead and do whatever they want. Social conventions be damned, and they could be spontaneous. They don't particularly like schedules, and this can be very, very difficult for rebels. And again, I think the flip side is all of these things can be seen as weaknesses, right? You know, if you know, I was recently talking to a friend who didn't want a conventional wedding, and it was very difficult to try and explain why parents and friends and other family wanted this traditional wedding environment. And the rebel just kept coming out, which was, you know, this is ridiculous. And why should we do things just because that's the way they've always been done? And I thought to myself, well, there's actually a deeper conflict here that needs to be resolved so that you can deal with that. And again, once that spontaneity and the desire to shirk those social conventions kind of settled down, there was a much more reasonable tone to the discussion. And I think that's why I think in the rebel capacity, it tends to be this, you know, I'm going to make a commitment. I'm not going to be able to make good on it, which was, I'm not going to be able to fit these social conventions. I don't fit that norm. And so therefore I don't even want to try it, right? But once this person was able to kind of put themselves into that role and say, oh, you know what? If I did this, I could do it my own way, fit the tradition, and still make everybody kind of happy, including myself. Now, all of a sudden, it was a much easier perspective. So, you know, you need to deal with rebels in a way that rebels want to be dealt with. And I think the best advice that Gretchen gives in the book is that she just basically says, give them the information, ask them to make a decision, and then leave them alone, right? Let them give them the freedom, choice, and so on and so forth to be able to make this. And this actually makes a lot of sense. I'm just going to go on a little bit longer about this because I think it's really important, which is Dr. Kenneth Blanchard wrote a book that's called Empowerment Takes More Than a Minute. And in that book, he gives these criteria for managers to basically empower their staff, their teams, with the authority, responsibility, accountability, and resources to be able to excel, to basically run as an independent team, empowered to, you know, meet their mission. And that is like the utter definition of how to help any of the personality types. But more than anyone else, the rebel is the one where that really speaks to them. That ability to have freedom and choice and to be able to deal with an environment independently is really powerful. Any final thoughts on the rebel before we move on, Frank?
Well, there was one little diagram in the book that I really liked and actually took a little snapshot in Evernote of this. Let's say you go into a public library and, you know, you see the sign, no food or drink. Well, the upholder's going to go, okay, well, then I won't bring in food or drink. Well, the rebel, who had not even thought of bringing food or drink, will make sure that next time in the library, he's armed with both food and drink hidden under his coat so that the librarian won't see him. He's going to beat the system. But there was a diagram in the book that had a little picture of an ant, and here's what was posted. Ants have been seen on this floor, and then in smaller print, help us protect the library's collections. And then underneath that in a little smaller print, no food or drink. So I don't care which of the tendencies you are, ants have been seen on the floor. Well, that's not a good thing. We want that problem to go away. And then it gives us a very clear, here's how you can help us with that, with the no food or drink. So if I'm a rebel and I look at that, I'm going to go, okay, makes sense to me. No food or drink. I don't want ants in the library either. So it gives us that way of being able to do things that are going to be accepted and understood by each of the four types.
Right. And this gives us our final tendency to discuss today, which is the questioner. And the questioner is in other personality type indicators would be considered very similar to the what some call the analytical, or sort of the person who really needs a lot of information before they make a decision. And the questioner, in terms of expectations the four tendencies, is as Gretchen Rubin describes here, data driven, fair minded. And of course, this is within his or her judgment. They want to create systems for efficiency and effectiveness, and they play devil's advocate. They are comfortable, shrugging the system if they believe it is not serving its purpose, and they're very inner directed and unwilling to accept authority for the sake of it. And this is the personality type for in terms of expectations that I think I probably have the most difficulty with, because I'm on this upholder obliger level where rules and outer expectations are important to me, that when someone questions a rule, right, it just seems, it's like, does not compute, Will Robinson. You know, I kind of short circuit, and I have to remember that my amygdala now has taken over, and I need to take a deep breath and let my neocortex really come back into power, because I really just don't know how to really rationalize that on a very deep emotional way. Do you have that same problem, Frank?
I do, and I think this is the personality type that can pose the biggest problem for an organization, because, you know, this is the person that is headed in a direction. You know, they are meeting inner expectations. They've got their eyes set point A to point B. Now, whether or not point B is the point B you want them to be aimed at, well, that's a whole nother story. So you got to make sure that they are sort of aimed in, you know, in the right direction. And if they are, it's great. You know, if their inner expectations meet up with what you would like those expectations to be, you're fine. But if not, they're headed off in another direction. They think they're absolutely right. And it can take the organization in a whole different way that you don't want it to go.
Yeah, I think that's really powerful to kind of note here, which is that you need to really find out what the inner expectations of the questioner is in order to really allow them to move forward. And if you yourself are a questioner, remember that there's a kind of hypocrisy built into your personality type. You like to question, but you don't like being questioned yourself. So you need to kind of become a little bit uncomfortable with that discomfort, very, very similar to Rebel's desire to be able to make fully good on their expectations, inner and outer, before they make a decision on one. You need to be comfortable with the fact that someone might question that what you believe is a fair or just decision or standard may be fair or just to you, but may not be fair or just to the other people in your organization, group, committee, family, what have you. And, you know, that's just something that questioners really need to toggle back and forth. And it's very difficult. I understand that. But it's something that I think if you develop that skill of being able to step back and say, okay, I've asked a lot of questions here. I'm not sure that I think some of this might just be arbitrary. Is it possible that I'm not answering the questions others have of me just as much as I'm asking the questions of them? And I think balancing that out, I think, can be very, very helpful for the questioner if you find yourself struggling with your team. And so, yeah, I think questioners generally, you know, you answer their questions, you give them all the information that they want, and figure out what their inner expectations are. Find out what is going to make them tick, and then you will find yourself having more success with them. So I think that's a good way to kind of deal with that. In all of this, Gretchen then wraps up the four tendencies as we wrap up our discussion today with applying the four tendencies in the final part of the book. And she talks about how the various things, and we've actually touched on a lot of these points about how to really deal with the various tendencies when, you know, you happen to maybe toggle, because it's a Venn diagram, you know, each of the tendencies kinds of overlap. So upholder overlaps with questioner as well as obliger. Obliger overlaps with upholder rebel. Rebel, you know, overlaps with questioner obliger, and then so on and so forth. So the reality is that we each kind of have a little bit of these, and I think I probably fit within that upholder obliger space of the Venn diagram. I probably am right there in that space.
Well, one thing that I thought was interesting, first of all, that she uses the Venn diagram rather than, say, four quadrants like the Eisenhower matrix. You know, she does see that, you know, you can have an overall tendency, but have some of the tendencies of another group, but it's only one other group. The way that she has this Venn diagram constructed, any of the four tendencies overlaps with one, like an upholder, can be an upholder and to some extent an obliger, or an upholder and to some extent a questioner. But there's no point on this Venn diagram that you could put that would put an upholder with any rebel tendencies, or an upholder who also has both obliger and questioner tendencies. And I thought that was interesting, that she didn't push those four circles a little closer together so that, say, there would be a point where you could say, well, I'm an upholder, but I do have some obliger, some questioner, and some rebel tendencies. And, of course, you mentioned you're an obliger, and you have the biggest problem with the questioner, which is the one that's on the opposite side of the Venn diagram. Those do not intersect at all. So I just thought that was interesting, the way that of how she has these circles overlapping.
Yeah, you can actually, I bet you that anyone can see who they have the most conflict in their life, and they can likely identify them as the opposite person on the Venn diagram. and so, you know, or you're the same, right? So if you happen to be an obliger and you live with an obliger, or you're a rebel and you live with a rebel, I would imagine that probably creates a lot of conflict as well. So my final thoughts here on the book, as we close out, is that Gretchen provided these four quotes from these fictional, you know, personality types that I thought were really interesting. So I just wanted to read them here. And she goes, "Upholder, this is something that should be done. I've got it. The questioner would say, why should I be doing this? Give me the evidence. I want reasons. The obliger would say, let me show you how well I can do this. And the rebel would say, don't tell me what to eat or how to exercise. And I think this is regarding the way they would respond to a doctor regarding rehabilitation for cardiac problems. But the reality is that it's a pretty general perspective on how these people, these tendencies, will respond to the same kind of request or, you know, expectation. So I just thought that was really useful. Final thoughts as we close out, Frank, on the four tendencies?
The biggest thing to me is, you know, as you're a teacher looking out into that classroom of students, you may peg this student or that student as one of these four, but in that classroom, you're going to have probably all of those tendencies. If you're the CEO and you look out into that board meeting, you've got people of all of those tendencies. So as we put together, say, a student handbook, classroom rules and regulations, or as we put together a company policy manual that's to be followed by everyone, that we write it in terms of it's going to be read by people of all four of these tendencies. And how can we write it in such a way that it is going to speak to all of those? So the upholder, here are the facts. Here's just what we want you to do. But for the questioner, for the rebel, there needs to be here's the rationale behind it. Here's the why. So if we write it in such a way that no matter who reads it, it speaks to them, then it's going to be a much more valuable document. It's going to be much more valued practice. So I think this is a model that's simple enough that we can all grasp it, and it's simple enough that we can all sort of keep this in the back of our minds. We can take a little screenshot and put it in Evernote of these four tendencies to remind us of what they are. And it's something that can, I think the big takeaway for me is to realize that not everybody is like I am, and not everybody is like you are.
Very much agreed. Very much agreed. I think going back to the top of our discussion here, I just want to put a fine underline under the fact that the four tendencies are related to expectations. I believe that they're not necessarily capable of expanding beyond that in terms of a full personality type indicator. But for where Gretchen has really explored this idea of how people expect things from others and themselves, it's a pretty powerful and convincing argument for it. So I think it stands in that strong area of theory, and I think it can be highly useful to people. So Frank, would you recommend this book to others?
Absolutely. One thing I like about it, I think it's long enough to cover the subject, but it's not too long. She really hit the mark with a book that is the right length, that is easy to read, that is enjoyable to read, and it's easily understandable.
Yeah, I think this book was written in the traditional Gretchen Rubin style, which is candid and her authentic voice. And I actually, in the second reading of this book, I listened to the audiobook, which is read by Gretchen Rubin herself, and I found it to be delightful. I thought it was a fun read. My book is still my favorite's Better Than Before, but if you have read Better Than Before, then this will be a wonderful sequel to Better Than Before. And as a standalone book, I think it's still worth the recommendation that if you don't plan on reading anything else by Gretchen Rubin, this would still be a very, very interesting and powerful productivity concept, so that you not only understand how you're most productive, but how others can be more productive in dealing with you and vice versa. So I highly recommend the book as well. This closes out the conversation for the summary review of Four Tendencies by Gretchen Rubin. Thank you, Frank, for this discussion and your insights.
All right. It's been a pleasure, Ray. Glad to be with you.
Of course, I have a few announcements before we end the call. First and foremost, I welcome you to join us in the conversation about Four Tendencies by visiting productivitybookgroup.org/community and joining us in the conversation about this episode and your thoughts and experiences on the book's topic. As well, feel free to visit productivitybookgroup.org and find out the details and the schedule for our upcoming quarterly book discussion calls. If you plan to read with us, feel free to visit the website, check out the schedule, and so there on the upcoming books page, you can join us in the live discussion calls. Feel free to visit iTunes, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your podcast, and feel free to subscribe or follow us there. Feel free to leave a review if you'd like to. That helps us expand our readership and bring new readers and callers into the Productivity Book Group fold. So thank you for that. Finally, all episodes are archived at productivitybookgroup.org under episodes. So if you missed a live discussion call, one of our author interviews, one of our summary review episodes, feel free to visit there to listen and join in the conversation as well. Thank you again to Dr. Frank Buck for joining me here on Productivity Book Group, and I hope you can join us next time. Here's to your productive life.